From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
And a very good afternoon to you. It's High 101.9. It's Kate Turkington. We're going traveling. We're going to be talking to somebody I'm sure you all know and certainly admire, the great man of music, Richard Koch. And we're going to be talking some fascinating books for you too. So welcome. And this week I thought, let's go. Remember last week, if you were listening, we went to Mpumalanga. We did the panorama route. We did a lot of stuff near home. But this week I'm actually going to take you to Tuscany and to Umbria. I mean, wonderful landscapes, rich history, great culture. And if we've time, a tiny visit to San Marino. San Marino, you may or may not know, is the world's oldest sovereign state. Dates from 31 AD. I mean, how many thousands? And it's about the size of Sandton City. I kid you not. It's got mountains all around it. You get wonderful views from the ramparts. But it's tiny. It's tiny. It's postage stamp tiny. And it's there bang in the middle of Italy. But Tuscany, of course, it's central Italy, often regarded as, I don't know, the pinnacle, the epitome of Italian beauty. You've got the rolling hills, you've got the vineyards, you've got those long roads lined with cypresses. I mean, Tuscany's inspired writers and artists for centuries. And of course, the cities, I'm overusing the word iconic. I must find another word, but they are cities that we all know and we look up to. And if we haven't been there, at least we've heard of them. So of course, Florence. If you're interested in art, in history, in beauty, in wine, in food, in almost anything, then Tuscany and Florence. I mean, Florence blossomed under the Medici family. I think they ruled Florence for about three centuries. There have been lots of TV documentaries and TV series about the Medicis. They were there from about the 12th century onwards. And of course, Tuscany claims and Florence claims it was the birthplace of the Renaissance. I'm sure that might be argued, but it's certainly one of the birthplaces of the Renaissance. So an absolute treasure trove, as you know, of art and architecture. You've got that magnificent cathedral, the Duomo. You've got the Uffizi Gallery with Botticelli's Venus rising from the foam and all sorts of other paintings. And then you've got the Ponte Vecchio. Oh, there's so much going on in Florence. And there's a boar. If you have been, there's a bronze statue of a boar. It's somewhere in the middle of Florence. And you rub its nose for luck. And it's got a very, very shiny nose because so many people have rubbed the nose of the boar. And, of course, I haven't even mentioned Michelangelo's massive marble statue of David in the Academia. Just reminded me actually of a story years ago when I was working for the BBC. I was sent up to a little Yorkshire town to cover a story. The story was that one of the local sort of little art galleries or little art shop had put a miniature statue of Michelangelo's David in the window. This is a true story. So, and the mayor was absolutely horrified. He insisted that the nether parts, which of course are bare, of David should be covered up. So it became a huge, huge, story. So it was a Sky News sort of story. And when I interviewed him, this is exactly what he said. I remember it after all these years. He said, "Art is art, and nothing can be done about it. But there's the Lady Mayoress's dignity to consider. I mean, you can't make up a story like that. So there you go. You've got Florence. There's, apart from the art, apart from all the paintings, all the wonderful architecture to see, you must go to that Ponte Vecchio, crammed with jeweler shops, also crammed with people, I must tell you. Try again not to go in July, August. May and September, always good months to travel in Europe, I've found. There are fewer people, better bargains, and just generally more, and usually good weather, too. You can go to the Gucci Museum and see the vintage handbags with the bamboo handles and other Gucci memorabilia. And gorgeous, of course, the gorgeous red carpet gowns. You can go to the leather market. There's an informal leather market. I bought a leather jacket there. I think the first time I went to Florence, it must be very old now. But you know, leather wears so well and always looks so good, even when it's so old. And as long as you get off the main square in Florence and go into the little streets behind, you'll get a good meal with a miserable glass of wine, because no other country in the world offers you glasses of wine like South Africa. I mean, they measure it out, 125 mils, 150 mils. But you can go into one of those back streets and get a really decent meal and a glass of wine, Vino da Casa, for a price that even we South Africans can afford. And if you are interested in literature, just pop into, there's a graveyard, quite a famous graveyard in Florence. And if you go to the English cemetery in Florence, you can see graves of famous people, including Elizabeth Barrett Browning's grave, which is quite a monument, actually. And then other towns in Tuscany I'll come to after the break.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
So you're with me in Italy today, and we're in Tuscany, and I've talked a little bit about Florence. I mean, even with all the crowds, it's still the most amazing place to go to. The little town of Siena, that's a lovely little town, and a favorite town of mine, Lucca, L-U-C-C-A. It's walled. It's still in its Renaissance style, not style, era, walls, and you can actually cycle along the ramparts. You can rent a bike very cheaply, and you can just pedal very slowly round the ramparts of Lucca, which is a very nice thing to do. And then Umbria, that has even fewer tourists than Tuscany. And nice cities again. It's a much slower pace of life there. You've got Perugia, which is the regional capital. You've got narrow streets, wonderful squares. It's also got some very nice modern architecture. And, of course, the famous Bacci Perugina chocolates. I mean, don't go to Italy if you're thinking of trying to lose weight or whatever. But, you know, you've only got one life. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And Assisi, of course, the hometown of Sir Francis of Assisi. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's actually a little spiritual and cultural gem. Beautiful church, beautiful panoramic views of the countryside. And, of course, you know, just talking food for a moment, both Tuscany and Umbria are celebrated for their, I suppose, world-class cuisine, you might call it. You've got Florentina steak, you've got pecorino cheese, you've got truffles, you've got hearty Tuscan soups, you've got, and then, of course, you've got the wine, you've got Chianti or whatever. And quite interesting in Urbino, another little town in the Ducal Palace, you've got something very rare in Renaissance art. You've got a smiling Madonna and child. You know, usually she looks so grumpy. And I'm just trying to think. Yes, in Montecchio, there's a painting, a Renaissance painting of a pregnant Madonna. It's the only known painting of the Virgin Mary, the Madonna, whatsoever you label her, when she's pregnant. And she looks exactly like a sulky teenager. She's clutching her tummy. She's pouting, looking totally miserable, which I suppose you would be if you'd just been impregnated by an angel. But anyway, lots of quirky things to do, things to see. And I haven't even talked about the countryside. I mean, the colours, if you go in spring or late summer, the scarlet poppies, the purple bindweed, the yellow-eyed daisies, the pink wild roses. Why do I remember all these colours? Because before I came on air, I was looking at some of my photographs, and that's what struck me. The wildflowers and the colours of the countryside, the green meadows, as I talked about before, those tall cypresses bordering the lanes, the old grey castle walls. Oh, such a beautiful place. And then, as I said to you, if you get time, go to San Marino. As I say, it's the oldest sovereign state in the world, dates from 31 AD, so we're talking well over 2,000 years. It's the size of a postage stamp. I think I walked it with a friend in the morning, and I don't remember it, as I said to you, being much bigger than Sandton City. But it's got lovely walls, and you've got lovely views over the surrounding countryside. So, a medieval city. It's almost a fairy tale-like atmosphere. Narrow cobblestone streets, small shops selling, of course, lots of tat. All these tourist places sell a lot of tourist tat. But if you look and you're careful, you will get the beautiful handmade crafts as well. And for history enthusiasts, San Marino's got a lot of actually very interesting sites. The first tower is the oldest of three towers, and you really do get, if you climb up that, you'll get wonderful views of the battlements. And if you go during one of the annual festivals, you know, we're so lucky now with Google and ChatGPT, you just ask them, what's going on in July in San Marino? And I'll give you a very good tip. If you do use ChatGPT, which I do, preface your search with act as if. Use those three words, act as if. So act as if you're a tourist going to San Marino in July. What would I see? And ChatGPT will come back with all the things for you to do. And the thing about it, then you can ask it, but what's the horse festival? What actually happens? So you can have this conversation. It's not like just going to Google and getting the site. You can actually chat to ChatGPT. If you haven't got it, just get it, ChatGPT. Go onto Google and download the app. Go onto your site, Chrome or whatever you use, and just download the app. And you can ask it anything. Act as if you're a GP and tell me why I've got a pain in my right toe. And it will come back and say, well, I'm not a medical practitioner, but these could be the reasons why you've got a pain in your right toe. I mean, talk about living in an age of communication. And lovely market, all these little towns in Tuscany and Umbria and San Marino. If you can go on a market day, then you'll get wonderful bargains. I bought jeans off the back of a lorry somewhere in Umbria, which I still wear, climbed into the back of a lorry to to try them on. Wonderful little local market. But as I'm going to mention later in the program, or maybe I'll mention it now, I was reading the New York Times this morning, and Turkey is the most affordable place in Europe to go at the moment. So if you can afford the airfare, because airfares are astronomical, Turkey is a very, very good place to go for an overseas holiday at the moment. Okay, that's all for travel today. Coming up shortly, we're going to be talking to one of my favorite people, Richard Koch, and a bit later on in the program, I'm going to be suggesting some books for you to have a look at.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
I'm not sure if my guest today would like to be known as an institution, but that's actually what he is. He's a South African institution. His name is synonymous with music, particularly classical music. Think symphony concerts, open air concerts, choirs, church music, baroque in the bush. Of course, it's the much loved legendary Richard Koch I'm talking about. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you, Kate. That was quite an introduction.
and heartfelt. Now, which of your many labels, Richard, you have so many, conductor, singer, organist, choir master, radio talk show host, which do you prefer?
Actually, maybe none of those. I think music entrepreneur would be the best one.
Okay. Talk me through that.
Yeah. Well, I think all my life I've liked to do things, and I think I inherited a sort of organizing skill from my mother. She was a great organizer, and I love organizing things and getting things going. I think maybe music entrepreneur and teacher would be best, because I've remained a teacher, even though I'm not a formal teacher. Basically, I've remained a teacher all my life, even if it's with adult audiences now, or 5,000 people at Starlight Classics. What I'm basically doing is teaching people and drawing them into my world of music. That's what I love doing.
And you've certainly done that. But how did it all start? I know you're a little schoolboy. I think you're about 9 years old or so in Port Elizabeth. How did the whole musical career start, Richard?
Actually, it didn't start. Well, I suppose it did start when I was little, because I went for piano lessons. That was my first introduction to music. And that continued virtually my whole life. But it was really when I went to senior school and I joined a choir that the musical flame was well and truly lit. There was an amazing director of music at the school where I was in Cape Town called Claude Brown. And he really lit the flame in me. And my family were going through a crisis at that stage. My parents got divorced, and he sort of took me under his wing. And I started organ lessons and got involved in the choir. And it was something where I found a real home. And while I was still at school, I was allowed to conduct the choir. And as soon as I left school, I became a church organist. So the training at school was good enough that I could step straight into a job while I was at university. And it really went from there. So I learned a lot from those early experiences. And it was church music that hooked me initially. That took me to the UK on a scholarship to study church music. And then I got a job in Chichester Cathedral in Sussex as a singer. I used to sing countertenor or alto. And I sang in that choir for 7 or 8 years. And then I came back to South Africa. And since I've come back to South Africa, really, I've done a huge variety of things, as you said in your introduction. And it's been a very blessed life I've had, because I've managed to do so many different things, not only musical, but administrative and upliftment projects, involved in projects in Soweto, all over the place, really. And that it's been incredibly rewarding for me, and I've grown tremendously over the years as a person and as a musician, being able to do these many different things that I do.
Just let's go back to church music for a moment, because, you know, when I think people think church music, I'm being very stereotypical here. I'm thinking sort of miserable chanting. I remember I went to a convent at school. I wasn't a Catholic. I remember singing in the choir at midnight mass, which was lovely. But church music sounds terribly esoteric and sort of out of the way of ordinary people.
You know, it's not really. Look, some of it is very traditional, and I brought up in a very traditional high church Anglican church, so where the liturgy was very important, and how the liturgy was done. But I realized very early on that liturgy is actually like a drama. It's a drama in many ways. And the music is very important to that drama. So, I loved that side of it. And I loved the whole movement and the music that went with it and all that with the liturgy. And from a parish church where I grew up in, Observatory in Cape Town, not where I grew up, but I was the organist there. I learned there. And then when I walked into the world of cathedrals, of course, the drama is at a much higher level. And it's very, very ritualized, if you like. And it was very special to grow up and spend 8 years, as I did, in that environment. I learned a lot from that. But church music does not have to be very staid and correct and chanting and so on. There are many, many different kinds of church music. And I'm still involved now. I've come almost full circle, because I'm getting more involved now again in church music. I've, over the last 30 years or so, I've been able to use church music as a sort of missionary activity by doing songs of praise.
Yes, which is wonderful.
I do many of them every year. We've got some coming up in August in Paarl and Hermanus. It's been a way for me to work in churches, although I'm not formally a church organist.
Now, you say songs of praise. Is that us all getting up singing Jerusalem? Just explain songs of praise.
Okay, songs of praise really encompasses the whole range of church music. You know, a lot of churches now have given up formal, old-style church music with organs, and they have music worship groups. And songs of praise can cater for people who've lost the old style of church music in their churches, and also encompass the more modern style of church music. And that's one of its strong points, is that it can be done with a band, it can be done with a brass ensemble, it can be done with organ, piano, and with all types of choirs. Also, church choirs have sort of gone out of fashion now, but songs of praise manages to bring people together to sing all different styles of church music, and to do it in a sort of cross between concert and church service. And people love it. I've done hundreds of them over the last 30 years, from Polokwane in the north to Plettenberg Bay, from Rustenburg to Durban. And everything in between. Small villages, big towns, with orchestra, with organ, just with piano, whatever is available. And it's managed to fit all of those things and bring inspiration to people. And people have loved it over the last 30 years, and it's still going on now.
That's great to hear. Now, you mentioned, and I immediately honed in on that word, orchestra, because you are known as one of our most famous and popular conductors. How difficult it, you've got a bunch of disparate people playing disparate instruments. How on earth do you weld them into one whole, Richard?
Well, it's actually it's about 90% psychology. and 10% of the music side, I think, because you've got to persuade those however many people they are, and it could be a small group of 16 or it could be up to 200 or 300 if you're dealing with choirs and orchestra. You've got to persuade them to do what you want to do, and you do it by a mixture of charm and discipline and musicality. I'm quite a gentle person, really, when it comes to this, but when the iron rod has to come out, then it has to come out because, you know, in the end, you've got to produce the goods. So I can be gentle, but I can also be strict when I have to be. And you do have to be. Music is a discipline and it needs disciplined control. And actually, when you're conducting, you are in control, completely in control. And in fact, if you think of it, you're the only person on the stage not making a sound. You have to do it by visual communication. And it's a skill that one learns over the years. When I started, I must have been pathetic, but you gain in confidence. And now by the time I am in my career now, people have a great respect for the history that you have of music making, and it becomes easier. So you often find older people are wonderful conductors, and they can go on until Herbert Blomstedt is still going strong at 94. And it's amazing. He doesn't have to do a lot. He just has to stand there and inspire people. And actually, it does really get easier as you get older. And just talking of orchestras, if people are interested, on the 23rd of July, I'll be working with Rocco de Villiers in a program called Rock Over Beethoven. And another of my strengths is that I'm not hidebound to classical music or to, you know, the more formal type. I love crossover music. So Rocco and I do this crossover concert called Rock Over Beethoven, where we have fantastic arrangements of Beethoven in a sort of modern style. Not only Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, Rocco's music himself. We do a wonderful version of the Moonlight Sonata for orchestra and piano. It was originally just for piano, but we've had it arranged. It's just, I mean, it's fun. It's a fun concert. And then we do another one with Charles Duplessis later in the year called Bach, Beethoven, and Boogie. So, I mean, there are lots of interesting ways of bringing music to people.
And that's Richard, what I... Where can people find the details of those concerts? What's the website?
Okay, the website is richardcock.co.za.
Oh, that's Richard's, so easy.
C-O-C-K.co.za. Actually, brilliant. If you just Google Cock, well, I mean, brilliant. Sometimes other matters come up as well, but richardcock.co.za.
Okay, that's brilliant. And I know you've got another Starlight Classic coming up in September, early September, which are always so popular.
Yeah, they are fantastic. That's an amazing festival of music, ranging from serious classical to pop.
Yes.
And everything in between. And it's beautifully done. It's highly professional. It's on a big stage, lights, sound, smoke. and as we said when we were talking just before we started recording this, you know, you get 5,000 people. And I love working a crowd. This is one of my favorite things. Some people get frightened by big crowds. I love a big crowd because you can actually pull energy out of them. And that's what I love doing, channeling the energy of the audience into the performers on stage.
And, I mean, you have conducted and worked with some of the huge names in music. I know I came to a concert where you were conducting with Joshua Bell, the violinist. Do you get nervous when you're working with those huge names?
I don't, actually. And this is, a lot of people ask me this question, don't I get nervous on the stage? And fortunately, I don't get nervous on the stage. In fact, quite the opposite. I'm very relaxed in certain circumstances because I love talking to the audience and taking them along, as I said earlier, on this journey. And that somehow relaxes me and enables me to enjoy the energy, as I said, that I get from the audience and from the orchestra. So a conductor is almost like a conductor of electricity, if that makes sense, between the orchestra. So I become like the sort of central point of energy conversion between audience and orchestra and performers. And in the process, I get energized myself. It's fantastic. In this age of, you know, load shedding, I get super loaded with electricity.
Don't tell Eskom them. I offer you a bribe. Anyway, Richard, let's come to really, really modern, not classical music. Do you have a personal favorite? I'm going to ask you, do you do pop? Would you choose a Taylor Swift or a Cher or a, I don't know. Do you have a favorite?
I don't have a favorite. I mean, I do have a favorite amongst more traditional composers, and without a doubt, it's Johann Sebastian Bach. He appeals to my cerebral side, to my musical side, in all of that, to my choral side, organ side. He's got many sides to him, and I just, of all composers, I love him the most. As with many people, he appeals to many people. But I don't have a popular performer that I particularly, you know, aspire to enjoying. But I do, and, you know, I've got another concert that I've got coming up is in Teberga or Port Elizabeth called Rhythms of Africa. And African rhythms really appeal to me, and African music appeals to me. So we got, you know, performers like Judah Sapuma, Tim Molloy, Luisa Bala, Nondi Mswetwana. The end of July, that's coming up in PE. And the other lovely thing, of course, is that I get to travel. I know you're a great traveler. I get to go to PE, to Durban, Cape Town, Bloemfontein, Baroque in the Bush. I've been lucky in being able to perform all over South Africa, and I still do, even at my extremely advanced age.
Oh, come on, you're a mere slip of a lad compared to me, Richard. And where do you have a favorite overseas place that you like traveling to?
You know, recently, well, not recently, but one of the best holidays we ever had as a family was in Turkey.
Oh, wonderful.
For my 60th birthday, we took, I don't know how you pronounce it, Goulet.
I've done those Goulet trips.
And we took the whole family. My sister, my brother came from Canada where he lives, and we took a Goulet with the whole family. And we went off to Turkey on around that coast from Bodrum.
For Tia, he has right the way along. It's wonderful.
Yeah, the best holiday ever, because we were all together. We could stop where we wanted to stop. We could stay where we wanted to stay on the Goulet. And it was just a huge amount of fun. I would happily do it again.
Yeah. I'm very lucky. I've done that Goulet trip 4 times, sometimes with family, sometimes with friends. A Goulet, by the way, is it's a small wooden sailing ship, like a small yacht. Obviously, it does have a motor too, but it only takes 10, 11 people. Maybe some are a wee bit bigger. But as Richard said, you just sail along the coast, you stop and you look at a Roman amphitheater, or you go off to buy a carpet. And by the way, hot off the press, I read in the New York Times this morning that Turkey is the most affordable destination in Europe at the moment, because the lira has sunk apparently even lower than the rand. So it's a really, really good destination to go to if you can afford the airfare to get there.
Well, I would happily go there again.
And Richard, where would you never go back to? I did a program recently on an anti-bucket list. I asked people, where would you never go back to? Do you have somewhere?
I don't really. I've never had a bad experience on a holiday. I do have places I would like to visit, and one of those is northern India.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I've never been to India, but sort of Rajasthan area. I would love to go there.
Oh, that's amazing. And when you can afford it, when you win the lottery, the way to do it is the Palace on Wheels, which is the train. So you travel at night by train, you wake up in the morning, there's a caparison elephant with painted toenails standing by your carriage waiting to take you up to some fort or palace in the hills. It's a wonderful thing. If I win the lottery, I will take you, Richard. There you are. That's a promise made, Don. That's a promise made. A promise made on air. And a very final question. You said Johann Sebastian Bach, but let's just forget Bach for a moment. Do you have one particular piece of music, not Bach, that is yours above all else?
Well, right at the moment, we're planning some concert. In fact, it's part of Starlight Classics. There's a beautiful little piece, short and to the point, called Salut d'Amour by Edward Elgar, Love's Greeting. And I performed it actually last Sunday also in Clough in Natal. And it's such a perfect little piece. It's warm. It's inviting. And I said to the audience there, actually, this is our love letter from the orchestra and from the musicians to you as the audience. And in fact, I think what I do in music is like have a love affair with the audience. Every time I perform, it's like a love affair. We come, we meet together, we spend an hour or two in each other's company, and we exchange love. And so if I, you know, if people can listen to this, Salut d'Amour by Edward Elgar, it'll take you 4 minutes, and it's 4 minutes of pure love, in my opinion.
Oh, Richard Kropp, and the website again, of, do we need www? Not really anymore. It's richardkropp.co.za. All the concerts are there, everything. Oh, Richard, such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Chat to you again, and lovely to see you also. I mean, your listeners can't see each other, but we can see each other,
exactly,
which is fantastic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
Now to talk books. And I've got a selection of very, very disparate books here for you. If you're a crime fiction fan, which I am, the latest Joe Nesbo is out. If you've heard of Joe Nesbo, you'll know exactly, obviously, whom I'm talking about. He sold over 55 million books. He's a Norwegian author. He has a protagonist called Harry Hula, who's one of these disenchanted, middle-aged, hard-drinking, world-weary detectives. But he writes incredibly well, Joe Nesbo, as I say. He's written so many books now, and he's sold over 55 million copies. So I picked up, it's published by Harville Secker. It's in all the bookshops at the moment, on the front, in the front row of the bookshop. The new one is called Killing Moon, and I picked it up with great anticipation, and it is as good as all of his books. But for me now, what it seemed, there's a lot of sado porn in it. Do we need really full-on descriptions of hideous murders, cannibalism, rape? I don't know. Look, the story is engrossing. It's 480 pages long. If you're a crime fiction fundee like I am, you will want to read it, but I don't know. I found it, maybe it caught me at the wrong moment. I found it a bit hard going on the details of the sadism and the murder and whatever. But that's Joe Nesbo, Killing Moon. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking just before Comrades, you may remember, with Bruce Fordyce. And a book that has come out, it's not up to 2023 by Tom Cottrell, called Comrades Marathon, 101 years of highlights and heroes from 1921 to 2022, published by J. Doubleday. If you're a runner, if you're a marathon runner, then you'll want to buy this book. So, I mean, the Comrades Marathon, think about it. It's grown over the last century, apparently from very, very humble beginnings, when only a handful of runners finished, to its current status as the world's greatest ultramarathon. And the book, I'm just having a sip of water there, the book tells the fascinating story of Comrades, its glories, its disappointments, its triumphs and tragedies, all the cliches, beginning with the early heroes, then when women first started, permission was granted for women to run it. I mean, that's how far we have come on, people. But in those days, you had to get permission, if you were a woman, to run Comrades. And then, of course, the Russians in the early 2000s, and then, of course, the ascent of our own black runners in the last few years. So Tom Cottrell, he wrote the Nedbank Runner's Guide to Road Races in South Africa. He's been a competitor, a spectator, TV broadcast support, and been captaining, in fact, the Omroute press trucks. So if you're a runner, or you're thinking of doing the Comrades, that's the book for you. Tom Cottrell, Comrades Marathon, 101 years of highlights and heroes from 1921. And then, last but not least of books today, a book many people will be interested in. It's the third edition of The Ultimate Guide to Retirement in South Africa, published by Zebra Press. The Ultimate Guide to Retirement in South Africa, and it's by Bruce Cameron and Vota Faree. And it answers questions like, what do you need to do to retire in comfort? What are the right choices to make before and after you retire? What are the mistakes that you need to avoid? How can you secure a sustainable income for the rest of your life? All these sort of questions. Lots of you will be interested in this. Many people, I don't think I've ever planned a retirement in my life. Well, I haven't retired yet. But just to give you some idea of what's in the book, how much is enough? I mean, what's enough for one person may not be enough for somebody else. Buying a pension, things like that, investing for an income, tax, estate planning, healthcare, civil service pensions, social grants, and then a very chapter I found interesting, the psychology of retirement, ageism, and mental competence. I think that's a very nice way, the mental competence. I love the expression I have in Ireland. They say, is she away with the fairies? They don't say she or he mentally competent. They say, well, he's a bit away with the fairies these days. So lots to do. Where should you live after retirement? Should you rush off to the coast and buy a place? No, is the answer, definitely. Anyway, useful contacts. It really is a book. If there's anything you want to know about retirement, this is the book for you. It's the third edition, so the previous two have sold incredibly well. It's right up to date, The Ultimate Guide to Retirement in South Africa by Bruce Cameron and Vota Faree, published by Zebra Press. Well, that's a very, as I say, a very disparate bunch of books for you this week. You've got the new Joe Nesbo, Killing Moon. You've got the Comrades Marathon. And finally, The Ultimate Guide to Retirement in South Africa. So happy reading. And you can always contact me. You can contact me at Kate at High, C-H-A-I, Kate at High dot C-O dot Z-A. You can contact me on Facebook, on my Facebook page, just Kate Turkington, or you can get me at my email address, Kate at KateTurkington.com. I'm always happy to give advice on books, travel, whatsoever. So that's all we have time for today. We've covered a lot of ground. We've done Tuscany and Umbria. We've done the Statue of David in a little Yorkshire town. We've talked to the amazing Richard Koch. And remember his website address, just richardkoch.co.za, for all those concerts and things he was talking about. And finally, the books. So lots of love, lots of life. Travel safely and carefully. Look after yourselves. And also, please look after others too.